Welcome to the Wolf of Yonge Street podcast. This week, I've got an ultra special guest for you guys. He's one half of the OG Canadian Investor podcast. It's a podcast that I listen to and I really value for their investment insights. So join me, everybody, in welcoming the magnificent. I've always wanted to do that. Braden does that every week.
Yeah.
Join me in welcoming the magnificent Simon Bélanger. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Victor, and glad to be here with you.
Before we get started, I would just like to let you know that none of the stuff we're going to talk about today is investment advice. So please feel free to always do your own research. But without further ado, let's get into it. I'm curious about your journey into investing. How did that get started for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I kind of was interested even like as I was a teenager. So I was really always pretty strong at math in school. So it's something that always fascinated me, anything like related with the economy. So that's how it started. I mean, I was, as soon as I turned 18, and I know you're much younger than I am, but back in the day, or my age, the online web brokers were just starting. So the commission was definitely much higher than right now. And at the time, I think it was like TD Direct Investing or TD Waterhouse, I think was the name. They kind of rebranded that over time. And then I started investing. I made early on a lot of the mistakes that probably, you know, you've made or other people have made. So I was kind of gravitating around like low price stocks. And when I'm saying low price, not the valuation, but the actual like dollar value per share. and the classic mistake, I got my friend's mom was telling me about this like junior miner who, you know, had found like diamonds in northern Canada, and they're going to be able to produce a lot of diamonds, make a whole lot of money. So I took a couple thousand dollars, which was a lot of money for me at the time, especially if you adjust for inflation, it's probably like $5,000-$6,000 now. And I put that money in and eventually went bankrupt. So I lost everything. Whoa. But because a junior miner, right, they haven't started production for the most part. So they're just, you know, finding deposits of whether it's gold, diamonds, whatever mineral it is. It's just one part of it. The actual extraction can be very expensive, and getting the financing for that is not always easy. Things that I didn't fully understand at the time, but it's fine. And I'm actually happy that it happened, because it's a lesson that I still keep with me today.
Yeah, it's crazy, because I had the exact same experience, only mine started in 2021. So I'm, as you mentioned there, I'm a baby investor in that way. I bought my first stock in early 2021, and in my mind, I was seeing all these things go up, you know,
number go up, yeah.
And I bought into the funniest things, you know. And then when it finally started to tank, I was like, oh damn, what just happened? Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's important. That's what we try to convey to people. It's more than just a stock. It's actually a business. And a good way to think about it is, if you have a restaurant near you, would you buy the restaurant if it was bleeding money and, you know, not profitable at all? Or would you buy it and pay a decent price for it if it was actually profitable? And sometimes I think people kind of forget it by looking just at, you know, stock tickers, almost like a casino a little bit.
Right. So, I mean, with that in mind, though, you know, we kind of understand that the way stocks move, you can't necessarily predict the way a stock is going to behave, especially in the short term. So, you know, how do you suggest people when they go to evaluate a stock, where do they get started?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is just learning about the company, just, you know, trying to invest in companies that you actually understand. I mean, I don't really invest in pharmaceutical companies because that's beyond my expertise. I don't really have an interest to learn about those. I'm not saying there's some good investments to be made there, but just companies that they can actually understand is a big start. And then in terms of evaluating companies, there's all different kinds of metrics that you can use. It will depend by the type of company, the sector. People may be familiar with price to earnings. It's just, you know, price to profits or price to net income. There's also the price to free cash flow, which is another profitability metric. Some will be better than others, depending on the type of business that you're looking at, but always looking at the actual valuation of the company. So how much you're paying for the amount of profits that you're getting. And, you know, you'll notice I'm talking about profits because I like to invest in companies that are profitable. When it comes to companies that are not profitable, it gets a little trickier, a bit more dangerous, because there's always that path to profitability, which may or may not happen. So that would be my kind of the starting point. And me personally, and it kind of goes back because I played poker quite a bit when I was younger, I like to think in different scenarios and probabilities of each scenario working out. So I'll look at a business, and you can take even a business as solid as Microsoft. A lot of people will think it's bulletproof and nothing bad can happen. But the reality is that every single investment you're going to make has some risk, no matter how safe you may think it is, whether the company is over, you know, trading at a high valuation multiple, that could be a risk because there could be a regression. And I think you can probably make the case that Microsoft is trading at a pretty high multiple, or even Nvidia, which has been, you know, the darling of the stock market so far this year and led by the AI boom. So I like to think in probabilities because, you know, whatever my investment thesis could be for a company, things can happen. Unforeseen events can happen. The economy could slow down. There's a whole lot of different things. So if you have, if you're able to think that way, then, you know, you'll be more aware of the potential outcomes, and then you can do a calculation for the expected value that you have for that stock within a time frame that you decide, whether it's 1, 5, 10, 15 years, whatever it is.
Right. So obviously things like price to earnings ratio are a bit of kind of easier concepts to grasp. And obviously a lot of the problems that people experience is just they feel, in my experience, that a lot of gaining that economic knowledge is a bit daunting. And how do you, the way I did it was I just jumped into it and, you know, learned by failing, and then eventually learned to evaluate companies, the quality of companies a bit better. But not everybody has that liberty. Not everybody is willing to lose money in that way. And I sure did lose some at the time. So, you know, what I wonder is how should people approach getting the right amount of economic education?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think it varies from individual into individual. I mean, I have a young daughter that takes a lot of time. I think the time you have to be able to read into that, the interest that you have, for some people it may come easier than others. There's a lot of good resources out there for people to look at. I mean, one of the really good sides, just to understand, is the basics of, you know, registered accounts in Canada and investing. I really like, I think it's called Get Smarter About Money. So it's a site that's from the Ontario Securities Commission. So it's a crown corporation from Ontario. They regulate financial markets, amongst other things. And there's a lot of good information for people to get started. But, you know, time is not always available for people to do that. And a great option, I think, for probably the vast majority of people is just to look at index ETFs. That's a great way to get some diversification. It's low fees. You'll still need to learn how to, you know, work your online broker, how to buy, you know, stocks or ETFs on there, but the learning curve should be much easier. And the time commitment is also much lower. So that's the approach I would recommend to most people. Most of my friends and family that, you know I do the podcast, they'll come to me and what should I do? I would say like 99% of them, I'll say, well, index ETFs is probably the way to go for you.
Yeah. And maybe I'll kind of back that up a little bit, because maybe there's people probably listening to this that don't know what an ETF is. And I would like for you to contrast that with what a mutual fund is. and sort of what the advantage and the disadvantage of both of them could be, if you could just do that for us.
Yeah, so ETFs are exchange traded funds, so they're available, they're traded on the stock market, just like Microsoft or any stock you can think of. The advantage with an ETF is there's a lot of competition. So especially with index ETF, it follows, and like not all of them will follow a major index, but you know, you'll have an S&P 500 index ETF, you'll have a S&P TSX or TSX 60. These are the index from, you know, companies listed in Canada. So what the index is just, you know, when you open the financial news, you'll see Dow Jones Industrial, S&P 500, S&P TSX, and these ETFs will just mimic the ETF. So what they do, whenever the ETF will just mimic the index. So what they'll do is when there's changes in the index, they mimic that. What ends up happening is that there's very low fees because management is not active. So you'll pay usually below 20 basis points, which is 0.2% in terms of fees. Whereas if you look at similar mutual funds, which will typically be offered by financial companies or banks, mutual funds will tend to have much higher fees. A lot of them will claim to be, I guess, they're closet indexing. I don't know if you've ever heard that term before.
Not really, no.
Yeah, but so they're basically mutual funds that say that they're actively managed, but the fund is oddly similar to the index, and yet you're paying much higher fees for it.
Yeah.
So that's typically, and what you'll see in Canada for mutual funds, you'll buy them directly from the bank. They'll kind of manage these mutual funds, and you'll see fees of 2 to 2.5% for these funds compared to, like I just said, 0.2 or even 0.06, 0.07, depending on the types of index ETFs that you're investing in. And it may not sound like a lot, and trust me, the banks will want you to believe that 2 and 2.5% is not a lot, but it's a massive difference. And I encourage anyone to take a compound income calculator and just put the difference. So you could use $10,000 over a 20-year period, and you compare 5% returns versus 7% return with that 2% difference, which would make up for the fees. And people will be astonished if they haven't done it before, the sheer, like, the difference it can do over time, because it compounds every single year. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the difference. I mean, there's ways, you know, if you get into the mechanics, that the way they function is different as well, but that's kind of a general idea of how they work.
Yeah, yeah, no, while I started like stock investing in 2011, I did get into mutual funds a lot earlier than that. And as I learned about stocks, I was just like, why am I doing this?
yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of competition in the ETF space, which is good because it does lower the fees. So typically you'll find an ETF from different providers that follows the same index. You'll maybe find five or six. I'll usually tell people take the one that has the lowest fee because it's the same index that it follows. I would refrain from trading in and out just to save a couple of basis points. So if one is the one you have has fees of 0.09% and the other one is 0.07%, I mean, I think it's fine. You can just stay in the one that's negligible. It won't make a big difference. But when you're talking about like a full percent different, that's where it's starting to make a big difference.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I mentioned, I consume a lot of financial investment type podcasts. And recently, so I'm going to shout out this podcast I watched on YouTube, Plain Bagel. I was watching a video of his recently where he basically came on and said, well, investing still won't make you rich, in the sense that he did this math where if you started with $10,000, you know, 1 year, and you added $3,000 per year, and you wanted to make $1 million at the end of that, you know, after taxes and inflation and fees, well, with fees not even factored in here, it would take you 53 years approximately to make $1 million. And it occurred to me that, well, that doesn't work for a lot of people. if you know what I mean.
Yeah, right? No, that's fair.
That sounds like a very long time. So is this the way people should look at investing? So when they start off investing and they're looking to make their future, is this really the way we should expect that, you know, without that, to even preface that a little bit, without adding $3,000 every year, just sitting your $10,000 a year and thinking maybe you're compounding at 10% every year, which is a standard for, well, I think it's lower.
Yeah.
It's much lower than that. But let's just say it's 10% for the S&P.
Yeah.
Then it will take you 80 something years without like you adding more money every year, right? So it's like that doesn't work for a lot of people. So is this really the way we should be looking at investing?
I mean, I think it's, I mean, I'll ask you a question before I answer. What's the alternative?
Oh, well, I did have a question. I have something for you on that. I have a question actually after that. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, I haven't seen the video, but I'm familiar with the plain bagel. And I think the one thing, like, I'm not questioning his numbers. The one thing I would push back is the way you framed it is that, you know, he assumes that it's in a taxable account. I think that's the first part. So obviously in Canada, we have a tax-free savings account. If people are looking to buy a home, we also have the first home savings account, which is a fantastic vehicle, by the way, probably underappreciated for a lot of people, just because even if you don't end up buying a home, you can actually, it'll just roll over into an RSP. So that's a fantastic vehicle. You have RSPs as well, where you can be very strategic in terms of, you know, contributing to your RSP when you have higher income years. And then even if it's not retirement, you know, I just had a baby not too long ago. If you have your income drops for a year or two because for whatever reason, you can be strategic and withdraw that RSP and have a lower taxable income. You can also use spousal RSPs if you have one member of the couple that is actually a much higher earner than the other. So there are strategies that you can use. But clearly, I mean, I'm not, the way I think to see it is just, you know, a way to invest in your future. I think that's the main thing for me. And obviously I don't only own stocks, I own other assets as well. But if you keep your assets in cash, even if it's collecting 5% right now, chances are you won't be meeting your very long-term goals. Shorter terms, there's definitely a case to be made to having some money in cash, especially if you have an emergency fund or a big expense coming up, or you have a down payment for a home that you need to have in a bit of a safer way. But I think for me, it's just still probably the best way to keep, you know, keep your buying power up and increase it over time. It does, you know, it does require you to put some money aside. And probably one of the biggest thing that's not talked enough in the finance world is how important your savings rate is. And I know it's not easy for a lot of people right now. A lot of people are struggling with inflation. The lower you are on the income spectrum, the more inflation is impacting you because there's a bigger proportion of your income going to food and lodging, which obviously leaves less and less money to be able to save afterwards. Yeah. So I would say, you know, it's not the only thing, but investing is definitely part of the solution. And the other solution, in my view, is just investing in yourself. So being able to grow that income so you can save more, invest more, and then it goes on and on and on. And then, you know, maybe eventually you'll be rich or you'll have, you know, financial independence. I'm a big believer. I don't really care about being rich. I just want to be able to be financially dependent and have more control over my calendar, if that makes any sense.
Right. So you mentioned the financial independence there. I'm going to throw in, make it a full fire.
Yeah.
So, you know, clearly there's a whole movement now where young people are craving more experiences. They'd like to, you know, get to a point in their career, maybe like 40, where they can go, you know what, I've done enough, and survive off their savings for the vast majority of their what is the rest of their life. How do you suggest people approach being able to attain FIRE?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm a big believer in having balance in your life. Let's say you're a 25-year-old and you want to basically retire by the time you're 40, that's all nice and dandy. But if you're, you know, you're cutting to the point that you're eating Kraft dinner for every single meal and you're barely doing, you know, anything with your friends because you want to save like as much money as you can, I'm not sure, at least from my perspective, that that's the best approach, is because you may not be alive at 40. No, but it's true, right? So I think you have to make a balance between enjoying life now and saving for the future. And I think that's where a lot of the FIRE movement, especially the ones that are really hardcore about it, kind of miss the mark, because, you know, I'll say personal experience here is I've been dealing with chronic back issues since I've been early 20s. I'm 38 now. And, you know, it's definitely limiting in terms of the things I can do. I do as much as I can to make it better, but I mean, it's never going to be back to 100%. And, you know, what if someone's 25 and they get a major injury and they have similar kind of problems and, you know, their goal was to get to 40 and then travel around the world? Well, that might actually be limited by the time they get to 40. So I'm a big believer in just balancing the now and saving for the future as well. I think it's the full-on FIRE movement, the ones that are really intense about it. I personally think they're missing the mark, but, you know, to each their own.
So a friend of mine once walked up to me. We both started investing right around the same time. And he said, if you can't double your money every year, he said, on the stock market, you're not doing it right. Because I guess someone told him that. And I said, I looked at, you know, the returns of like Warren Buffett and you know, Charlie Munger, and I was just like, well, surely he's not better than them.
Yeah. And that mindset, I mean, I think it's probably a reflection of, you know, younger generation and just seeing things that are in their mind not achievable by doing it the old-fashioned way. So saving, putting your investment in, you know, an index fund, like I mentioned earlier. They just see, you know, in Canada, we have, I think it's safe to say, a housing crisis at this point. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with it in BC and in Ontario as well. I mean, in Ottawa, it's not Toronto or Vancouver, but if you want a home that's, you know, either a semi-detached or fully standalone home, you're not going to be getting much unless you have at least seven, like, you know, you pay at least seven or 800,000. So to be able to have the salary for that and save up the down payment for that, which could be, you know, at the very least 50 to 60 grand if you just do the minimum. It's not easy for a lot of people, and I think there's a lot of younger people that just get discouraged and figure, look, I need to, lack of better words, gamble in the stock market to be able to double my money every single year so I can achieve those dreams. Problem with that is, sure, it might work out. It may work out. You may, you know, get lucky and double your money for several years in a row or more than that. But you're either going to get rich or go broke. So it's basically one of the two. And yeah. I'm going to go and say that the probabilities are probably in the favor of going broke with that kind of strategy.
Right. You should believe the poker player. He knows.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really, you know, something I was really passionate. I worked on it a whole lot. But poker, I think it's a great teacher for people to think in probabilities. I think anyone, obviously, play within your means. I'm not encouraging people to go and gamble necessarily. But I put a lot of work into it. And the best example is if people familiar with Texas Hold'em, if you go all in before the flop and you have aces against most other hands, you have about 80-85% chance to win. If you play enough, you'll know that, you know, that 15-20% chance to lose will happen. And I think that's a good reminder, because people tend to see those pocket aces and think they're invincible, but the reality is they can still lose.
So as part of the whole gambling phenomenon, though, there is obviously a balance here between like buying penny stocks, which may or may not be worth, be backed up by actual, you know, quality, by value. But there's also the part where, you know, for example, people that are in private equity, will get early access to companies that are kind of new in their development process. And obviously, there's a chance of you finding value in the sort of small cap market, if you like, in the penny stock market. And I wonder what the approach is. Is it just do you walk into penny stocks knowing that you're going to lose maybe half of them or maybe 80% of them? And are you just willing to accept when you do that, okay, maybe the 10% that does make it is going to make up for all the others?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably referring more to venture capital at that point.
Yeah, because
private equity tends to be, well, the way I see it, it's more like, you know, taking oftentimes public companies private. They're called something leverage buyout. So they fill up with debt. They kind of try to bring efficiencies and then try to exit 5 to 10 years later. But for venture capital, yeah, that's exactly what you said. It's typically they'll take a shot of a lot of different types of companies. And then, you know, I don't know the exact ratio, but it's probably similar to what you said. 5 to 10% of them will, you know, be able to fuel most of their gains, and the rest will probably be zeros eventually. And that's how they approach it. But these are typically very nascent companies. These type of investors will usually have a lot of experience. They'll probably focus on what their expertise is more aligned with. So some will focus a bit more on certain types of tech companies. You know, there's not just tech companies that are venture. There's other type of companies as well.
Yeah.
You know, Dragon's Den is pretty much that, right? They're venture investors, or Shark Tank in the US would be the same thing. In terms of penny stocks, I mean, the approach I would do, and I don't really invest in them, but it's still looking at the companies and the actual numbers. So you want to see that the company actually has revenues, the company is actually growing. Chances are it probably won't be profitable at that stage, especially if it's really early on, if it's on the TSX Venture, for example. But at least if there's a progression, try to get as much information as you can on the company. Listen to conference calls when they're available. Do the same kind of research, but probably allocate a bit smaller percentage of your portfolio to each company, because the outcome is most likely asymmetric, meaning that I'll take an example. Let's say it's 1% of your portfolio. You invested in a very micro cap company, so a company that has maybe 50 million in market cap. Well, if the company goes to zero, you lose your investment, so you lose 1% of your portfolio. But if the company, you know, 10x's in the next several years, then it will, you know, if everything else stays flat, then it will be 10% of your portfolio. So the bet is definitely the various outcomes are, you know, you can either go to zero or it can be a phenomenal performer. And that's why you allocate a smaller percentage, because if it does go to zero, you're not wrecked.
Right. So the other asset I thought I'd touch is a cryptocurrency market.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the last, it's kind of cooled down now and it's starting to heat back up for at least the biggest cryptocurrencies in Bitcoin and Ethereum. But, you know, a little while ago, there was like the cryptocurrency craze, the mad dash for Dogecoin and everything at that point. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what future you foresee for cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I've, full disclosure, I mean, I have a pretty big allocation to Bitcoin in my portfolio, a little bit in Ethereum, but I haven't added to Ethereum in quite some time. And I've gone through, you know, severe corrections more than once. So I have a high tolerance for volatility. I think that's important to say, because not everyone has the same tolerance as me. I started investing in Bitcoin in early 2018. So you probably weren't following it at the time, but there was a big initial coin offering boom in 2017. Bitcoin ran up to about 20,000 at the time, and then it crashed back down to like within a few months to like $3,000-$4,000. So I had a big crash. And obviously, we saw the run-up in 2021 and then the resulting crash. We also saw these exchanges. So whether it's Celsius, BlockFi, these lending platforms that were centralized, we also saw FTX with Sam Bankman-Fried, who was just convicted of 25 years in prison for fraud just a couple weeks ago or last week. And when it comes to cryptocurrency as a whole, I kind of see Bitcoin a bit of as a standalone, and then there's the rest. You know, Ethereum, I will most likely be selling my position over the next few years slowly. I already started a little bit just because I have more conviction in Bitcoin. And the reason for that is, first of all, it has a longer track record. With the ETFs that were launched in the US in January, there's definitely more interest into Bitcoin. I think there's more and more people that see it as a store of value, although, you know, depending on your definition of store of value, because it is clearly volatile, but I think it's something that also people see that it's not in good control of governments, where you have central banks in Canada and the US, you know, you don't really know what they're going to do, what's going to influence the currency, our money. And with Bitcoin, you know what the protocol is going to be. So there's a level playing field. And I think one of the biggest bull cases for Bitcoin specifically is what we saw back in 2022. So when Russia invaded Ukraine, what I think is one of the biggest mistakes from the U.S. Government and, you know, its allies was to freeze Russian assets in U.S. dollars. The reason why I think that was one of the biggest mistakes is the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world. And, you know, most of the trade is done in U.S. dollars, because if you're Japan and Australia, you may not want to have Japanese yen if you're Australian. And if you're Japanese, you probably don't want the Australian dollar. So you agree in a currency that you both agree on, which is typically the US dollar. But with the US freezing assets with, you know, adversaries or people they don't align with, it does give a lot of caution to countries that would be okay with the US right now, but will they be okay with the US in 5, 10, 15 years? And, you know, Bitcoin or gold are definitely good alternatives in terms of that. And obviously, if you're in a country, and we tend to focus on Canada because our currency has been relatively stable over the years. But I mean, talk to anyone that's in Argentina, in Turkey, anyone who has seen hyperinflation, having something like Bitcoin for them is really, you know, kind of something that will allow them to keep their purchasing power, no matter how volatile it is, because it's way better than whatever currency they're using in those countries. Plus, if you have, especially if you have cold storage, you're able to travel very easily with Bitcoin from border to border, and you're able to carry your wealth with you. So there's definitely a lot of things to like about Bitcoin. And obviously, the maximum amount of available supply of 21 million that will ever be created, much different than the constantly growing supply of fiat currencies, whichever one you want to pick.
Right. So maybe I'll ask you a little bit about Ethereum here now, because I like to think of Ethereum as, or the future of Ethereum as, in a way where we end up applying the technology, like the, I guess they're the ones that own the smart contract. I'm not fully familiar with. So perhaps there
is. To be fair, it's not something I used to follow Ethereum more, but now I don't follow it as much. There's been a lot of different upgrades recently, but right. I'll do my best to answer your question on the
left. Yeah. So is there a future where we apply, if not, like, obviously Ethereum is not meant to be a store of value in the way that Bitcoin is. But as sort of like a platform upon which, you know, people are building other applications, or, you know, some of the tech from Ethereum, do you see that being ever applied to future financial systems?
Yeah, I mean, Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, seems to believe that a lot of things could be tokenized. So whether you think about stocks, bonds of companies, they could be tokenized. And clearly, Ethereum would probably be the blockchain of choice to do that. So that would, people may say, okay, what the hell does that mean, tokenizing stocks or bonds? So think about it this way. When you buy a stock on your broker, so let's say you buy one share of Microsoft. Well, the trade is actually not settled. Usually it's the time of the purchase plus two. So it's not going to be settled for another couple of days. So there is a time delay between that. Whereas if you would use blockchain technology like Ethereum to have it tokenized on the blockchain, you could make those transaction almost instantaneous. So a change of ownership that would be able to happen. A lot of people have thrown tokenizing real world assets and things like that. I don't know whether that would happen or not at some point, but the biggest attraction here is the almost near instant settlement of these type of transaction in the future. And that's the biggest thing about, even if you take Bitcoin, right? If you have someone you want to send money to, like halfway around the world, like I'll use Japan as an example again, using Bitcoin, if you have their address, you can send it to them. Usually it'll take about 5 to 10 minutes maximum. Try the traditional way to do it. It's most likely going to take you days. The fees are going to be higher. So that's the attraction of blockchain. It makes things, the settlement of things much faster. One of the biggest downsides, whether you agree with that or not, is that transactions cannot be reversed. So if you send it to the wrong address, you don't have a bank to reverse a transaction. If you get hacked or anything like that, I mean, there are ways to limit the risk of that, but that is definitely one of the downsides.
Interesting. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about, we've kind of touched different assets here. We've touched cryptos and stocks. And I wonder what your point of view is on, I happened on an argument, a debate on a podcast I was listening to recently. And they were basically discussing stocks versus real estate investing. If you could pick, obviously, this isn't, real estate is not necessarily for beginners because it requires a huge capital outlay, right?
Yeah.
So now you know what side I'm on right from the start.
Right.
But between investing in real estate and in stocks, how do you suggest people look at investing in these assets?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you said that because Dan Foch and I, so he's the co-host of the Canadian Real Estate Investor podcast, which is under our podcast network. So we're actually going to release a stock investing versus real estate investing episode at the end of the month. It's going to be a two-parter, one on our podcast, one on this podcast. It's already recorded, so I'm pretty well versed on this. Right. There's all the first thing, obviously, it's a low barrier to entry for stocks, like you mentioned. I mean, I did a little project where I was just putting $50 a month in an index fund last year. And, I ended up the year with about 7% returns. And my $630 invested was around 670 or around there. So it just goes to show, you don't need, crazy sums of money to actually be able to invest in stocks. Whereas real estate, I mean, if you get CMHC insurance, you'll be able to, put 5% down. But if you're looking at, obviously, if it's owner occupied, if it's an investment property, it's different. But you're still looking at $25,000 in terms of down payment if you want to buy a $500,000 home. And if you put 5% down, you essentially have negative equity in the house, meaning people kind of forget that, but you have the closing costs to pay, land transfer fees. You also, the CMHC insurance, which tends to be just tacked on to your mortgage, but that will most likely be tens of thousands of dollars. So at the end of the day, if you put 5% up to about 10%, you have negative equity in the home. So that's not great because if you lose your job or if something bad happens, You're in the hole. And then we come to leverage, where obviously if you're buying real estate, you're levering up. So using leverage, it's great. But, you know, if things are going well, it supercharges your returns. But if things are not going well, you can actually get, again, the opposite effect, right? Because if you buy a house, and I'll keep things simple here, you put $200,000 down, you buy $1 million home, you have an $800 mortgage, the home goes up 20%, it's worth 1.2. Now you've doubled your money. But the other way around, same $1 million home, you put 200,000, goes down 20%, you have an $800,000 mortgage, and your home is worth 800, you've basically wiped out your equity. So I think that's, you know, it's just something important for people to remember. But again, you can use leverage to invest in stocks as well. So you have to be careful whenever you're using leverage. I mean, it can really go both ways. But let's be honest, real estate, you don't really have the choice to use leverage. The other reason for stocks, I would say, is diversification. Again, going back to index ETFs, you can literally put $50 a month, and you're instantly diversified in thousands of businesses. Whereas if you're, you know, investing in real estate, chances are you'll only be able to put, you know, buy one piece of property at a time. May take a lot of time as well. And with stocks, you can buy REITs, you can buy real estate investment trusts as well. So you can get that exposure. And there's kind of a couple other things I would say. Liquidity. Most stocks you'll be able to sell pretty quickly. I say most stocks because if we go back to penny stocks, if there's a very low volume of trades, you may be able to sell it, but you might not be able to get the price you want. Whereas real estate, obviously, it takes a long time if you want to be able to, you know, sell the home. Even if it's a hot market, it's going to take you several months by the time before you list it, sell it, close. Maintenance and repair. A lot of people tend to forget that you have to maintain and repair your property. That won't be the case for stocks. And I think the last thing would probably be fees. There's a lot of fees associated with real estate that people don't realize. And, you know, I think too in stocks, and we talked about it before, or both our experiences is maybe a downside there is that people invest in companies that they don't really understand. Whereas real estate, I tend to think people will learn a bit more about it. But again, that could be a risk for both.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of things that I feel people miss when they invest, they forget the effect of fees. They forget the effect of taxes. And they also, obviously, inflation is has now come to the fore a bit more. You realize, you know, there maybe a reason for getting into investments a bit more is because, well, cash is slowly getting devalued over time. That's just the way it is, right? So I wonder how you would speak to people approaching, obviously, you know, in the long term, you know, the less taxes the more tax instruments you're able to use, tax advantaged accounts you're able to use, the more money you keep in your pocket, right? And I wonder how you would speak to that for beginner investors who do not understand some of the different tools they can use to better take advantage of tax advantage.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the two better known in Canada are RSP and TFSA. Again, there's still a lot of myths around the TFSA, I would say specifically. Every year, I think it's BMO or one of the big bank does a survey, and every year people are, you know, answer like they think they know how they work and they answer incorrectly when they're actually asked questions.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, I'm a big fan of the TFSA because it provides tax certainty. So you get taxed now. You put the money in TFSA, any gains you make within the TFSA is tax-free at that point. When you withdraw the money, it's also tax-free. The RSP is a little trickier because you have to do some projections and assumptions that will be in the future. And obviously, things can change. Tax rates can change. You don't know what your income is going to be in 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now. That's going to impact your taxation. The way an RSP works is you put money now. You do not get taxed on it, so you get a tax credit, and it's a tax deferral vehicle. So any money you make within the RSP without withdrawing it is tax-free. And then when you do withdraw it, it actually adds to your taxable income. So you're deferring taxes. The whole idea behind it is you want to make sure you're getting a credit because you're paying more in taxes now, and then you'll pay less in taxes later. So you're trying to defer the taxes then to make sure that it's more advantageous from a tax perspective. My rule is I would say for most people, again, it's not investment advice, but you typically would want to max out or maximize those two. So the TFSA and RSP before you start investing in a taxable account.
I see. And obviously there's the first home savings account, which I truly believe people should take advantage of as well, right?
So it's like a hybrid of both, basically. Yeah. So it's like a TFSA and RSP together. So it's like you get the tax credit for contributions, and then you're not taxed on the money at all as long as you use it to buy a home.
Right. So how would you if I had $1,000, for example, how would you rank these in terms of where should I put my money first? So as I max out one of these tools, where's the next place I should put my money? How would you rank their utility in that way?
Again, I think it's really a more of a personal thing, I would say. Typically, the lower your income, more advantageous the TFSA will be because you won't be taxed all that much right now. And right. The higher the income, then the RSP may become a more valuable investing vehicle. So I think that's typically the general rule of thumb, or if you want to have certainty. And that's where the TFSA really comes in. For the first home savings account, I think for that, if you're looking to buy a home, even if there's only a 10-15% chance that you might, I think it's a great account because if you don't use it to buy a home, it rolls over to an RSP. So I think that's really good. And obviously, if you're a parent like me, an RESP is also a great investing vehicle because you can save money for your child's education down the line. And you also have access to government grants. There are limits to that. But the idea is that when the money is taken out, it's taxed at the child's taxation level, which typically when they're studying, it's there's almost zero tax taken from it.
Right. So from the perspective, just switching gears a little bit as we kind of come to the end here. So from the perspective of a person starting to look into stocks, say, you know, they've looked into ETFs, now they want to get into stocks. You know, there's obviously a balance between proper diversification, which is a situation where you try and, you know, vary the sectors that you're investing in. I'm just to clarify for people who are maybe a bit newer. And there's also the balance of diversification versus dilution, because, you know, at a certain threshold, if you invest in too many stocks, then your returns are significantly diluted. So in terms of how many stocks, I'd like to get your opinion on how many stocks people should look at in terms of creating proper diversification while also avoiding dilution.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it's always, you'll see all different kind of recommendations. So I think it's really, personally, once you get over 30 individual companies, it tends to be very diversified, I would say. And 50 plus, I think studies have shown that the returns tend to, obviously depending on the type of companies you're investing in, but they tend to start mimicking the index. So, you know, are you better off just buying an index ETF than doing that? I think it comes down a lot of it to time commitment, because if you have 50 companies, are you able to keep up with those 50 companies? And you have to be honest with yourself. I used to have 20, 25 companies, and now I'm down to about like 10. So I use a more hybrid approach. So I use, I invest in index ETFs. I have some individual companies. I also have, obviously, crypto, which is mostly Bitcoin. And I have some cash as well. And I think that's important because you see on FinTwit a lot of the time, I'll see discussion where people, it's like, oh, you should only pick stocks. You should only do index investing. There's nothing wrong with doing both. And I think it's important for people to just think of what works best for them. If they just don't have time to follow companies, then forget about holding individual companies. Just buy the index. you'll save a lot of time and you'll probably end up having better returns, because if you're picking individual companies and you're not doing the proper research, unless you get pretty lucky, you probably won't have that good of returns. So I think it's just, to me, it just comes down to being honest with yourself, and the time commitment is a big, big part of it.
Right. So I think what I'll make my final question is, I want you to speak to, you're obviously a retirement expert, right? And I wonder how you would suggest people in different points of their career. So maybe a person at the beginning of their career, a person in the middle, and a person closer to retirement, how would you suggest people approach, you know, the kind of assets they should hold and what their investment strategy should be?
Well, traditionally, you know, you want to be mostly, like, the traditional answer is the younger you are, the more you want to be as close to 100% in equities or stocks. That's just a synonym in case people aren't sure. And then as you progress closer to retirement, then, you know, you have a bit more focus on stock, but also a bigger percentage in fixed income. So that includes bonds, that includes money market funds, that could include GICs. And then as you get really close to retirement, there's even a bigger allocation to those. So that's the typical kind of rule of thumb that you'll see. There are funds that will do that for you, target date funds that adjust automatically over time. So that's a great option for people who want to be kind of hands off. Personally, I'm very reluctant of putting any money in bonds, just because there is some interest rate risks with bonds. So a lot of people perceive bonds as being super safe. And if you were in bonds in the last 3-4 years, you can tell that it's not as safe as people can see. And to me, I see risk as the, you know, the potential of losing capital. So right. I don't really equate volatility to risk. I think personally, it's the wrong way to look at risk, right. Because you can have something that's very volatile, but the risk of it going to zero is much lower than one that has maybe less volatility. But what I've been, you know, for myself, I've been putting, I do have some fixed income right now, and it's typically shorter term treasury bills, whether it's treasury bills from the government of Canada or the US government. And I have a bias towards US government just because it is the reserve currency of the world. And treasury bills is just a fancy word to say that are shorter duration. So if interest rates go up and down, they will follow, but you won't lose any capital on it. Whereas right. if you have a 10-year bond and interest rates go up, your bond is going to lose in value because the market will say, well, you know, we'll buy your bond, but the new ones are actually yielding much more. So we'll give you less money so the yield actually matches to what is offered. And I think that's a big, big risk right now. And that's something I'm not touching personally. So my fixed income is typically in just short-term treasury bill right now. So that's the way I see things. And if I were closer to retirement, then I probably would just have a bit more treasury bills than I do currently.
Right. Well, that was thank you for giving me your time today. And you've given initially when I wrote to you, I was like, no way, I look up to this guy so much. No way he's gonna do the podcast. And then when I saw your answer, I was like, yes.
We try. Like, I know it takes a lot of time to do podcasts, and clearly you're passionate about it too. So I try to, whenever I get requests, either me, Braden, or one of the real estate guys, we try to accommodate. Obviously, we have busy schedule, and I know we had to reschedule. So I do appreciate that. But thankfully, you know, it was good that we scheduled because I was starting a cold. So at the end of the day for our original date. So now I'm actually coming out of it. So I'm sounding a bit better.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Well, thank you guys for joining the podcast today. I'm going to obviously link where you can find the Canadian Investor Podcast down below. So you guys go listen to the podcast. It's a great resource for those of you starting to invest here in Canada. And if you just want to learn in general how to start your investment journey. So thank you guys for listening. Don't forget to subscribe down below. See you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wolf of Yonge Street podcast. If you derive value from this podcast, please don't forget to subscribe. I would love to hear from you as well. So please comment your thoughts down below.